Welcome to a La Trobe University podcast. I would be your host, Matt Smith, and my guest today is Dr. Ramon Spy, a senior research fellow from the La Trobe Refugee Research Centre. Thank you for joining me, Ramon.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Now, with the 10th anniversary of September the 11th just passing, the world has spent a lot of the past decade focused on terrorism activities. One particular form is lone wolf terrorism, which has been the focus of Ramon's research and will be the subject of his upcoming book. Ramon, if we could start with how you would define a lone wolf terrorist.
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. Actually, a question that's been debated by quite a few academics and particularly also journalists and policymakers. I think the way I look at lone wolf terrorists are those who engage in acts of terrorism, meaning with the aim to basically communicate a broader political message through installing fear, creating that culture of fear through the use of violence by destabilizing a government or creating significant panic among a significant population. Lone wolf terrorists then, within that broader framework of terrorism, are those who operate individually, alone, and are not connected to any official, known or identifiable terrorist group, whether they are more of the sort of hierarchical type or more old-fashioned type of terrorist organization or more of the decentralized network, homegrown terrorist networks or cells. So very much an actor that acts alone and may actually be very much directly or indirectly inspired, whether it's through the internet or through some form of contact with ideologues pertaining to particular movements, but that in the end acts without the outside command and support and very much engages in an act of terrorism individually and autonomously.
Okay, so they don't have to have direct links to a terrorist organization. So kind of walk me through the criteria. What makes a lone wolf terrorist and what falls outside it? They don't need to have a connection to a terrorist organization. They have to act alone.
I think those are the main ones.
Yep.
Admittedly, the boundaries of lone wolf terrorism are inevitably fuzzy. Mm. We're talking now about the comparison with group actor terrorism. But of course, you can also compare it to say, other forms of criminal activity. Think about lone assassins and things like that, mass murderers. How are lone wolf terrorists different there? And I think there what's important is the communication of a political message, albeit in a way that, of course, is deemed illegal and can cause significant damage and pain. It's about that wider political, ideological, religious message. So that also separates it from criminal activities engaged in mainly for personal or criminal reasons.
So there has to be a driving ideology of some sort there.
Exactly. I think what is important to keep in mind is that it's not necessarily clear what this ideology is, even if lone wolves themselves portray publicly a particular ideology, be it in a manifesto on the internet, be it in the media, be it in statements in court. These ideologies are much more complex and much more mixtures between particular political agendas and sort of personal frustration and aversion.
How have lone wolf terrorists changed over time, and did 9/11 and the war on terror affect things at all?
They're very interesting questions. I think first of all, as with terrorism generally, lone wolf terrorism is obviously not a new phenomenon. It has been around for centuries. So I came across quite a few examples, for example, from a 19th century anarchism, where some anarchists, definitely not all, because the majority actually reject the use of violence, but theorists such as Mikhail Bakunin, for example, he advocated propaganda by deed, and particularly what he called individual acts of resistance, including, for example, the murder of political leaders. Taking it to the present, we've seen a major rise in lone wolf terrorism as a strategy in the second half of the 20th century, particularly from the 1970s, where the concept of leaderless resistance became increasingly prominent among right-wing extremists and white supremacists and Christian fundamentalists in the United States. Lone wolf terrorism, as you see it today, that's sort of its historical context from which it's developed. And then we get also to 9/11. How it's developed over time is that it's now increasingly recognized as a significant, effective strategy of inflicting pain and attacking an enemy from a variety of political, ideological, religious backgrounds. So not just related to sort of more the far right, and particularly the US far right.
Are they effective at all?
I think overall, they're not. If you look at the actual damage done, so the lethality of lone wolf terrorism is actually very low. On average, lone wolf terrorist attacks kills less than one person. There are significant examples, the recent attack in Norway being one, but overall, it's seen as not so much an effective strategy. However, where it is more effective is in creating a culture of fear, the fear that an individual could strike at any moment, at any time, and may well go undetected by law enforcement. That's one of the interesting trends we're seeing post 9/11, is that even Al-Qaeda, for example, which itself has always been what we might call a network of networks, now more and more tries to inspire homegrown cells and also individuals to take up arms in the West, in the countries where they live, to strike against Western targets. And very much now also advocating the strategy of leaderless jihad, so individual jihad, not committed necessarily by a group or directly related to an organization such as Al-Qaeda, but very much also by individuals, because this is seen as much harder to detect for law enforcement and intelligence agencies.
Now, you said less than one fatality on average. Does that include the terrorist?
That actually does include the terrorist.
Oh, and wow.
I assessed the lethality of lone wolf terrorism in 15 countries, including Australia, over 40 years. Mm. And the average lethality of an attack is 0.6 lives per attack. And that ranges from a lot of unsuccessful attacks or attacks where, for example, the bomb detonated too early and only the perpetrator actually got killed by his own bomb, to the maximum we've seen now, the Norwegian attack recently in July. Very exceptional, with 77 people killed in two attacks. The bomb in the government center of Oslo, and then later on the island of Utøya at a Labour Party youth camp, where 69 people were killed. That might seem like a lot, and it is, causing significant damage and significant heartbreak for the Norwegian population. But overall, if you look over the more historical context, lone wolf terrorism doesn't cause a great deal of casualties. Having said that, one of the famous sayings attributed to Mao, but I personally don't believe that it was actually Mao who said it in those words, is the idea that terrorism is a strategy to kill one but frighten 10,000. Mm. So it's actually not actually about the number of people you kill. It's about that culture of fear and by intimidating a much larger population. So fundamentally then, in terrorism, the primary target is actually usually of secondary importance to the secondary target, which is the wider population, government, and often very loosely defined. For example, in the case of Islamist terrorism, as crusaders, Zionists, the West, in very vague abstract terms, rather than specific as the people we're actually targeting.
Are there certain characteristics that lone wolf terrorists tend to have, and are they disturbed individuals?
It varies. So I did a comparison of lone wolf terrorists versus terrorists who operate in groups. And there's a significant psychological literature about this. Terrorists do not exhibit any identifiable psychopathology. In other words, terrorists are strikingly normal. However, if we look at lone wolf terrorism, we do see that a relatively large number of individuals do exhibit some form of psychological disorder, ranging from very mild to more serious. There, it's again important to note that that doesn't lead them to be cognitively disorganized. So terrorist attacks are usually very carefully planned, even by individuals. Now, if you look at the recent attack in Norway, that was planned at least for 4 or 5 months in detail, but even up to 9 years of preparations leading up to that attack. In other words, it's not something that's generally done in the spur of the moment by a mentally deranged individual, even though lone wolf terrorists may exhibit certain aspects of psychological disorder that may help shape that violent radicalization process. And I think it's very good then to look at radicalization as a very complex, multifaceted phenomenon, where psychological factors are one amongst many more, including inspiration from larger movements, or sometimes, for example, a terrorist imagination that he has the solidarity and support from a larger movement when in fact he's actually acting on his own, and in retrospect, his deeds have seriously condemned by some of his would-be supporters.
After the fact has happened, a lot of information comes out about them, and a lot of people say, look, we should have seen these indicators before. This was well known about this person online, but it was kind of ignored or dismissed. Should it get to the point where we would be able to track the people who are likely to become lone wolf terrorists?
I think it's very important there to distinguish between the how and the who of lone wolf terrorism. Generally, it's understood now that there's no point in trying to figure out who are going to be the terrorists. Under the right circumstances, basically anyone could become a terrorist, depending on group influences, sociological factors, some psychological factors, etc. And much more fruitful to actually look at the how, so particularly behaviors that might be suspect. Think about online purchases of chemicals, and particularly large quantities of chemicals that can be used in improvised explosive devices. Particular confessions or warning signals made to neighbors, friends, family members, or other community members about an upcoming attack. Things like that, people who see strange changes in people's behavior. It's much more focused then on the how rather than the who. Having said that, it's extremely naive to think that we will live in a society where terrorism attacks will not occur. What can be done through measures such as the ones we've just discussed is basically minimize the risk to some extent. But I think equally important is to look away from criminal justice approaches and also particularly war approaches, as we've seen post 9/11. And to also look more at conciliatory responses, particularly to think about how we might address certain grievances through a democratic process with respect for human rights and civil liberties, rather than more and more imposing more security and surveillance measures and creating the surveillance state, often with the illusion that safety in that way can be guaranteed. To some extent, we'll just have to accept terrorism and also lone wolf terrorism, even though lone wolf terrorism is only a fairly marginal aspect of terrorism more generally, as something of a normal, manageable risk among many other risks in society. The most effective response to terrorism is not to be terrorized. It's not about the actual killing of people. It's about the broader message, about that wider secondary target to which this message is communicated to. The effect of terrorism is very much in the eye of the beholder, whether people let themselves be terrorized or not. I think that's quite a fruitful way of looking at terrorism and lone wolf terrorism in particular.
Ramon, your book is Understanding Lone Wolf Terrorism, and it's to be published in December 2011 by Springer Publishers. If you'd like to ask any questions, comments, or feedback about this podcast or any other, you can send us an email at podcast@latrobe.edu.au. Dr. Ramon Spy, thank you for your time today.